Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. My name is Paul Malik, I am the Curious Political Editor, and I am joined this week from across Scotland in Edinburgh. Joining us as the P&J's Political Editor, we have Tom Peterkin. Good morning, Tom. We have Mr. Derek Healy, he is joining us from Dundee, he's the Courier's political correspondent and investigations editor for the Press and Journal. Also in Edinburgh is none other than Mr. Callum Ross. Good morning, all three of you. Now, it's a bit of an exciting podcast this morning, not so much because of the politics, but we will try and shoehorn it in. But Scotland reached a major tournament in the football, men's football, I should say, for the first time since 1998 last night. So if, like us, you are nursing a sore head or sore throat, please bear with us. We will try and update you with all of the happenings of the Scottish politics and beyond this week with our show. First up, we have had the latest on the Salmon Inquiry and a MSP who will be stepping down, who was embroiled in the saga right back at the beginning. Mark MacDonald has reared up again. And Callum, you've been following that story for us. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, of course, Paul. It's quite an interesting one. I actually started working at Holyrood for the Press and Journal in the middle of October 2017. And within a couple of weeks, one of our local Aberdeen MSPs, Mark MacDonald, had resigned in this storm of controversy relating to the whole Me Too movement. So it was a story I was involved in covering at the time and obviously remember it well.
What was it he did, if you could refresh us, or alleged to have done?
A lot of it centred, certainly initially, around a message on Twitter that was sent to a woman. I won't repeat the exact wording of it, but he said that he was... Please, he made a joke, as I think he would have seen it at the time, about whether his autocorrect had changed a word to a sex act, a word used for a sex act. There was a standards commissioner investigation at the time, and he was kind of found to have breached the code of conduct by sending this message, and there was an element of harassment said to have been involved in it. There was another breach of the code of conduct, I think, as well, in relation to some loan of some money. There were some other allegations that didn't end up being taken forward in that inquiry, but those are kind of the key aspects that were looked at the time. Now, the Alex Salmond allegations didn't really come out until the following summer, so probably like a lot of people, I just kind of assumed there was no real connection between them other than the fact they were both senior SNP figures and that their accusers had come forward in the wake of the Me Too movement. But then I kind of started looking last week into some of the evidence to the Salmond Inquiry, and it struck me straight away that the timing of the two cases were much closer than I had thought. In particular, the First Minister's Chief of Staff, Liz Lloyd, said in her evidence to the inquiry that she first found out that a news story might run about Mr. Salmond's conduct on November 4th, 2017. Now, that was the same date that Mr. MacDonald resigned from his role as childcare and early years minister. And he's already said in interviews in the past that it was Miss Lloyd who was the person who said to him he would have to resign as a result of this Twitter message that had emerged. Not only that, a couple of weeks later, the evidence showed that there was a private secretary in the government who described Mr. MacDonald's exit as the justification for the government creating this new harassment policy that would go on to be used against Mr. Salmond. So I kind of started to wonder if the two cases were a bit more connected than I'd considered in the past. And I spoke to some people who knew Mark well, and they had reached the same conclusion, really, as a result of the evidence. In fact, they said they believed Mark MacDonald had been thrown under a bus to engineer a justification for this new harassment policy that would go on to be used against Mr. Salmond. Obviously, the government denied this, saying Mr. McDonald resigned because of concerns about his conduct and that the policy had been in development for some time before that. But it's certainly an interesting angle there, potentially, in terms of the Salmond inquiry and whether it relates to Mark McDonald's case as well.
Tom, I think it's fair to say that the Salmond inquiry is murky, to say the least. There was a few other developments that have taken place with letters back and forth between lawyers and the Scottish Government. Could you talk us through a couple of them? You've been following that this week, haven't you?
Well, I think you're right to say murky, Paul. One of the big frustrations of this, or perhaps the overwhelming frustrations of the MSPs on the committee, has been their failure to extract information from the Scottish Government. And in fact, there was a letter from the committee convener, Linda Fabiani. She wrote to, in fact, both the Scottish Government and Alex Salmond himself. Alex Salmond, as far as the committee concerned, they're still waiting for his written evidence, which, you know, normally comes before he gives them oral evidence by appearing personally in front of the committee, so that they're getting frustrated by that. Alex Salmond argues that he can't get access to all of the evidence because of various legal restrictions facing him. And the Scottish Government, the MSPs on the committee are demanding that the Scottish Government hand over the legal advice that it received ahead of the judicial review that Alex Salmond successfully took against the government. The Scottish Government is arguing that these documents are protected by legal privilege, but the committee argues that, well, legal privilege has been waived in the past. So there's a bit of a standoff, the committee have said, we're in the countdown now, because the committee have said, well, look, there's a... you know, we give you a deadline until the end of today, that's Friday, to hand this stuff over. So that it's yet more examples of how the committee feels that it's being frustrated by the failure to get all the documents it feels it requires to conduct a proper examination of the circumstances surrounding this whole saga.
Now, Tom, another story you've been working on this week has been the inspection into the police complaints procedure, including issues with perceived racism in the force and issues over the length of time it takes for inquiries into deaths in custody. You've spoken to some of the players involved in that. Could you talk us a wee bit through about what that report was? And I appreciate that it was a 500-word report and it might not have been too easy to digest, but what were the main takeaways from it?
Yeah, as you say, Paul, it was almost 500 pages. It was 488 pages, so a very, very comprehensive review conducted by Dame Elish Angelini, a former Lord Advocate. And it was looking at the handling of complaints, investigations and misconduct in policing. And so, as I say, and so looking through it, it was really a very interesting read indeed, and the thing that really stuck out, as you say, was this idea of racism within Police Scotland. And you know, Dame Elish said that Black, Asian, and minority ethnic officers are quitting the police because of the way they're treated. She said that female and LGBTI members of the force are victims of deeply concerning discrimination. There was a particularly, what I thought was a particularly sort of revealing quote. She said, "Much of the evidence presented to me by some serving officers from Black and Asian and minority ethnic communities was a chastening reminder that in the police service and in the wider community, attitudes have not changed as much as they should have since 1999, the year of the McPherson report of the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, or as much as we may like to believe that they have." Now, of course, that's obviously a very obvious reference to the sort of Touchstone report, which was produced by William McPherson, which got a huge amount of publicity about the racially motivated attack on on Stephen Lawrence and the aftermath of that, and in particular his finding that there was the great phrase was that there was institutional racism in the Met Police. So, I mean, someone like Dame Alice Angelini does not say these things lightly, I would have said. And there were also sort of a lot of very interesting and worrying evidence was submitted to her when she spoke to officers from minority backgrounds. One, for instance, saying that he had, well, we don't know what gender, but a former complaint had to be raised as a result of racial abuse received from colleagues, but there was no support and protection. Officers were asked if they would recommend a police career to others from a minority background. All but one said that they wouldn't recommend joining the police. On the subject of promotion, one officer said that it was easier for a person from a black, Asian, or minority ethnic background to become a doctor than to become a sergeant in the police. And some contributors believed that racism was more prevalent within the service than within the community, and that racist attitudes were imported with new recruits. So one of the main key recommendations was that, and I should say on the issue of sexism and so on, there was talk of underlying sexism and differing degrees of machismo culture in different parts of the service, and some male officers struggling to cope with having a female manager. There was a lack of understanding with LGBTI police officers. So it was really, you know, pretty shocking stuff. And one of our key recommendations is that there should be a broader review into this, and that there should be officers should be given diversity training and so on. So it was a report that we were expecting to find stuff on the handling of deaths in police custody, which of course we did. There was a very important recommendation that these cases should be treated with the same urgency as homicide. But you know, one of the things that really stood out was this pretty damning verdict on police culture within the police force, as far as the treatment of people from treatment of women, treatment of people from minority communities, and the treatment of LGBTI officers.
Yeah, that they're really sobering, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what have the Police Federation or the Police Scotland, what have they said to it? How have they responded?
Well, there was a lengthy statement from the Chief Constable, Ian Livingston, which he thanked her for her significant work, and said that racism and discrimination of any kind is deplorable and unacceptable, and he utterly condemned it. No place in society, no place in policing, which of course, you know, is to be welcomed.
That's all fair and well saying that, I imagine.
But. Yeah, well, that's right. The proof of the pudding will be in what action is taken, whether these, you know, these unacceptable attitudes are tackled head on. Obviously a lot of work to be done.
That's can be quite worrying for people.
But, you know, the fact that police officers are from these backgrounds feel that they can, you know, they're having to leave the force is particularly damning, you know, in you know, that was one of the key things she had identified.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, given the amount of time from the McPherson report as well, that, you know, was before, you know, it was the 20th century. It's been a long time since that came out. And it was a long time, and even more times from Stephen Lawrence's original murder and investigation, which caused it. And you would hope that we'd have a bit more positive news on that front in terms of how our black and minority ethnic police officers feel in their workplace. Now we have further COVID news this week. Perth and Kinross, Angus and Fife joined Dundee into the level 3 lockdown. And Derek, you have been covering that as the Courier's political correspondent, and you've also been looking at contact testing, and there's been a bit of a kerfuffle, to say the least, over data and how that's been recorded. Why don't you try and talk us through the wiles of data and trying to get on top of this coronavirus pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. So on the contact tracing, first of all, so last week Public Health Scotland discovered that there had been what's been described as a coding error with the test and protect data, which masked the fact that the system had been up to 5 times less effective than previously stated. So this error overestimated the number of people contacted within 24 hours of testing positive, because it counted everyone who had been reached the following calendar day within that bracket. So in effect, you could be tested at 9 a.m. on a Thursday morning, and you would still be counted in that 24-hour window so long as you are contacted before midnight on Friday, even if, you know, obviously that stretches well beyond 24 hours.
And this is the NHS Scotland Test and Protect app that we should have on our phones, yeah?
This is all contact tracing. So this is anyone who's testing tracing, positive, yeah. This takes it in. Yes, it's the Test and Protect scheme that's running, yeah. So I think the worry here is that this mistake really masked some apparent failures within that Test and Protect system during September and October, when it was absolutely vital. The Scottish Government insists it didn't lead to an increased spread of the virus. Opposition parties have repeatedly said that there's simply no way of knowing that. The system is now working well in meeting World Health Organization targets, but what we know is that for 8 consecutive weeks at the start of the second wave, it was not meeting those targets, and that wasn't clear because of this error. On top of that, we know that contact tracers have been unable to reach more than 3,500 people who tested positive in Scotland. 400 of those were just in the last week. So Nicola Sturgeon says that's simply just down to people not picking up their phone or reading their texts. But she was challenged about that at First Minister's questions, because only around 40% of close contacts are currently being telephoned. And until now, text messages have really played a big role in that communication, something that, again, opposition parties don't feel is good enough. We have been told that should improve going forward, and telephone calls will play a bigger role in this for the contacts of people who have tested positive. But there's obviously a legitimate question around why that's taken until mid-November to sort out.
And is there any suggestion as to why that's been the case?
Well, I think it's just been the way Nicola Sturgeon and Health Secretary Jean Freeman have been insisting that this is a system that is working well. And I mean, I think that's probably fair to say now that it is meeting those targets. But I think opposition parties would very strongly argue that there has been failures here. And I think that's something that ultimately is going to have to be looked at. It'll probably be looked at within the wider way that this pandemic has been handled, but I don't think we have a definitive answer. And if you're going to have kind of really quite basic data problems, I mean, that is a pretty big mistake to make. I realise the effect of it maybe isn't that big potentially, but it's a pretty basic level mistake to be getting wrong in terms of your data. And if you're going to have those kind of problems going wrong that we know about, I think there is questions to ask about how well the system is working.
I mean, you said it was 5 times less effective. Does this mean that there's a possibility that some of the areas where the prevalence of the virus is quite high, you know, like Dundee and the Central Belt, could be forced to go into level 4 lockdown? Was there any indication of that from the First Minister or the Health Minister this week?
I'm not sure. I mean, as you say, so the big news going into today is that Angus, Fife, Perth and Kinross are all joining Dundee in level 3. We knew that going into the review this week that no areas were going to be moved down a level, despite local leaders in Aberdeen suggesting that they have quite similar indicators to the Highlands, so should be moved down to level 1. This was the first weekly review of that new system, and I think there was actually quite a bit of frustration when it was announced on Tuesday. I think the hope was that those quite tough decisions made during the first week to really be quite cautious might be able to be revisited. And I think particularly for some areas of Tayside, like Montrose, where case numbers are quite low at the moment, it was probably a pretty bitter pill to swallow. We know that these decisions have been made on a council-by-council basis, but Nicola Sturgeon told us that an area's reliance on a particular hospital, for instance, or proximity to other areas could be factored in, and we could see decisions being made across health board areas. So I think really that does go back to some of the concerns that were discussed behind the scenes by opposition parties before this new system was announced that, you know, okay, we may not have a national, may not have a nationwide lockdown, but large areas of the country may need to be kind of lumped in together. We've seen that in the central belt for obvious reasons. And I think there will be a concern of how difficult it might be for areas in courier country to switch down to lower levels if neighbouring councils are still struggling. One of the big kind of battlegrounds has sort of been Aberdeen. And in the case of Aberdeen, Nicola Sturgeon said it was not in the interest of areas to be moved down prematurely because that could mean the virus getting out of control. And then you have restrictions being lifted and reimposed over and over. The Scottish Government have repeatedly kind of refused to rule out that we might have to go to level four at some point in some areas and some groups of areas particularly as well. So it's not something that's being ruled out. I think the general push of areas is obviously looking and hoping to be moved down. And it does seem as if the kind of rise in transmission rate has been curbed to an extent at the moment. But Nicola Sturgeon is very keen that we see an actual, you know, a substantial reduction in this, and a continual substantial reduction. And I don't think that's happening yet.
All right, so still some way to go, even though we had news this week of the vaccine, of course. And just hope really that we can get on top of this sooner rather than later. For one particularly silly reason is that for the first time in 22 years, the Scottish National Men's Football Team have qualified for a national tournament. Now, wouldn't it be the most Scottish thing in the world? Wouldn't it be the most Scottish thing in the world, though, if we had qualified for this tournament and then it gets cancelled because we haven't got on top of the pandemic? There's quite a lot of overall support for the men's team and this idea that there's this glorious failure that we've had to put up with for the 22 years past. I know I have. I was nine when Scotland last played in a national tournament. And the politicians like to get involved in the national team as well. We saw Nicola Sturgeon tweeting her, celebrating her victory in East Dunbarton. The party's victory in East Dunbartonshire. With Amy Callaghan meeting Joe Swinson, which was rather weirdly, I suppose, but there's nothing really weird in 2020 anymore, but rather weirdly, retweeted and celebrated by Michael Gove, none other than the Duke of Lancaster himself. Is there any suggestion, and this might be just clutching at straws, that there's a confidence in Scottish politics that goes hand in hand with Scottish sports doing well? You know, does Andy Murray winning at Wimbledon make it more or less likely that Scotland could, you know, vote for independence or push for more devolution? Tom, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's obviously a huge, I mean, some absolutely brilliant news. I mean, in an incredible, incredible game. I mean, we went through the usual sort of trauma that seems to be associated with Scottish football, but this time it had an incredibly happy outcome, although I think everyone's nails are shredded. So it's just fantastic. And unlike you, Paul, I'm someone who, because I'm old, I can remember 1978, the bitter disappointment of Argentina, which was which came after sort of a sort of huge national feeling of positivity that, you know, and Ali McLeod saying that, you know, we're going there to get a medal, and there was a victory parade before, but they were on the telly all the time. Everyone in 1978 seemed to wear one of these wonderful Scotland strips with the collars, and I think as an 8-year-old I even had one myself. There's a huge, I remember the sort of appalling despondency afterwards, the Willie Johnson affair and all the rest of it, like everyone else who was around at the time. And obviously it's going to be, you know, hopefully Scotland will do well and it'll be just a wonderful thing for the mood of the country. As to what the impact it has on politics, difficult to sort of measure, I suppose. But funnily enough, I've just come off the phone before the podcast to an expert on these things, a guy, Stuart Wiggum at Oxford Brookes University, who's sort of done studies on these sort of things. And in a nutshell, he was saying, well, you know, yeah, for the first obvious thing is that the politicians won't be able to help themselves to try and to be seen, to be associated, you know, there's accounts of politicians of all persuasions to be associated with whatever, you know, feeling of upbeat feeling there is and the success of the team and all the rest of it. They can't help themselves, I suppose. But he was sort of saying, well, yeah, this feel good factor, if Scotland do well, could contribute to a feeling of political confidence. But he says, you know, don't overstate it. He says there's still big questions. You know, the far more important things as far as the constitution is concerned is going to be the big questions of the currency, the border, the economics, that sort of thing. So while it, you know, it may feed into something, he was of the view but that there will be issues other than sport that play a more important factor, I think.
So you're trying to tell me that David Marshall's save hasn't solved the currency issue then?
It was a brilliant save though, wasn't it?
And Callum, obviously, goal hero Ryan Christie is a good Highland man like yourself. Do you think football and politics should mix as much as we're maybe the politicians would like to see?
Well, I'm a big fan of Mr. Christie now after his goal last night, but he's an Inverness Cali Thistle product, and I'm a Ross County fan, so I wasn't too fond of him before that. I think Tom's right. I think you can overplay these things. On the surface, you wouldn't imagine it's going to harm the Yes movement having a massive game against England next June in a tournament, our first tournament in 22, 23 years. You wouldn't have thought it would harm it, but I think most people that would be likely to be influenced by those kind of things, the kind of fervor that comes with these big games, probably already made their mind up in the constitutional question anyway. So I have my doubts that it'll be a game changer, but you never know. It might play a part along the lines somewhere. I actually I'm just kicking myself because I went to bed when Serbia equalised last night, assuming it was going to be another glorious failure. But my dad took me to the most of the France 98 qualifiers, so I was there when they qualified for the last tournament. So I've still got those memories myself.
Magic. And on that, I think we should draw it to the close, where maybe next week we will discuss whether or not Scotland versus Italy has saved the Union. I have been Paul Malik. Thank you once again to Tom Peterkin, Derek Healy and Callum Ross for joining us. This has been The Stooshie. Join us at the same time next week. Bye.
The Stooshie is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshie today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshie Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshie from DC Thompson Media.